Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we present the second installment for 2023 of our popular feature, Landlord-Tenant Law. In preparing for tonight's broadcast, I took a look at our program from 3 years back. That was May of 2020, to be exact, just to see how much things have changed. You know, during the pandemic, we saw numerous emergency measures designed to protect individuals and homes and businesses who lost their ability to pay rent in the face of COVID. Even as far back as 3 years ago, we were discussing the slow pace of a return to normal after it seemed the worst of the pandemic had passed. Yet back then, we were still remote broadcasting. Now we've returned to the studio. But are some of these emergency measures really here to stay? Anybody looking can see that inflation's here. Is there a recession on the way? Rents may have been capped. Repairs and upkeeps, maybe not so much. How do these forces affect the housing stock? And what's left of the pandemic measures? Are they truly gone? What are the relatively new laws? What if these laws remain to protect landlords and tenants alike? And what other new developments may be on the horizon? You know, as Dean Johnson commented this past January, our landlord-tenant broadcast have become something of a tradition, and we always get the best questions and comments from you, our listeners. So give us a call. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And bear in mind that our attorney guests are here to educate and inform, but they can't provide specific legal advice for specific cases, which, of course, they haven't seen. But they're here to help. They're here to sort out what they can, give you guidance, and as you try to sort out all these legal principles. And returning tonight, our guests are three of the Bay Area's top landlord-tenant attorneys. For some 20 years, San Francisco landlord-tenant attorney Jessica Chalik represents clients in rent board actions, mediations, and in court for landlord-tenant issues. Jessica launched her practice to specialize in San Francisco residential evictions, vacancy agreements, and rent board petitions for tenants, landlords, master tenants, and subtenants. San Mateo attorney David Finkelstein is a graduate of NYU School of Law. David's admitted to practice in the states of California and New York, beginning his career as a staff attorney in California for the National Housing Law Project at Bolt Hall Law School. I guess it's no longer called Bolt Hall Law School, at Berkeley Law School. David has been representing clients in real estate and landlord-tenant matters for some 40 years and has published articles about protection for renters during the COVID-19 crisis. Also joining us tonight is San Francisco attorney Sal Timpano. Sal is considered one of the top attorneys in the Bay Area to practice in the area of landlord-tenant law, representing both landlords and tenants in the area of eviction. And without further ado, Sal, David, Jessica, welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Good to be back, Dave.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So the last time we were doing this show in January, there was some breaking news that the President of the United States said he was then considering instituting by executive order a renter's bill of rights, effectively instituting a national rent control. Thus far, has anything come of this?
Not really, Jeff. As far as I am aware, the situation is that the order saying that the Department of Housing and Urban Development HUD needs to look into that and make sure that the formal process is followed. I don't know that there is an effective law immediately.
Has anybody really worked out whether this is really a good idea or not?
I don't think it makes sense. One size fits all across the whole country for tenants. It just doesn't, to me, it doesn't make sense. And I think what I've seen here in Northern California is a more of a movement toward forcing the localities to build more affordable housing. And that's where I'm seeing the, and I think that makes sense. And I wish there were more of a national program to develop affordable housing rather than a national program for tenants' rights.
We already initiated somewhat of a statewide rent control in California. Is that still in effect?
It absolutely is, Jeff. That I think what you're referring to is the Tenant Protection Act of 2019, and it spans all of California. There are many counties that don't probably need it in California because they're so small, but it's ranges statewide, and it's not simple. You know, I mean, it might be easier for attorneys that practice in landlord-tenant jurisdictions that have, you know, rent control and eviction control. There'd be some familiarities there, but otherwise, it's a complicated code section. So anyway, it's there, and there's nothing in that code section that appears to be going away at all. I mean, it's the legislature has put it on the books, and it's a California code section now. So.
To make it more difficult for landlords and even for a lot of attorneys, that law, the Tenant Protection Act of 2019, allows more stricter regulation of rentals by counties and cities. And so somebody comes into my office, we always have to check the statewide rent control, the county rent control in the particular county that the property is in, and then the city law for the particular city. And things have become a lot more complicated. In a way, it's good for a lot of attorneys because what was formerly mostly done by property managers it's too complicated even for some attorneys. It's too complicated for most property managers, and more of them are coming to us attorneys for it. I don't know if you find that, Sal, as well.
I do, and you know, it'll you know, they'll get educated and they'll be able to, you know, do a lot of stuff in time as well. But for now, they are calling the attorneys to get our interpretation. We don't have all the answers either, right? You know, like you said.
So jurisdiction-oriented, like in San Mateo, a landlord will come to us to do a three-day notice to cure a non-monetary defect or to quit. And where we are, we have to do that. Then we have to serve a second three-day notice that they haven't cured in the 3 days they have, because our judges here won't evict without 2 3-day notices. But I don't know how many other jurisdictions have that.
We don't in San Francisco. Oakland has a 10-day notice, I believe. Yeah. I think it's still in effect. San Francisco does not.
San Francisco does have the 10-day warning letter for everything other than non-payment of rent. That is still in effect.
Yes,
have to give that 10-day warning before you do the 3-day notice to cure or the 3-day notice to quit.
Yep, thank you, Jessica. You're right. I was thinking of non-payment of rent cases only, but you're right about that. It's a 10-day letter that says you're going to get a 3-day notice, so it's a warning letter.
It's interesting. One of the things I'm gleaning from talking with the three of you. is that this runs so counter to so many areas of law. Generally, when the state issues a paradigm or a mandate, it preempts any local involvement so that the state can have a uniform practice. And it seems that in landlord-tenant, it's just the opposite. The state wants to leave the door open for anything more restrictive than what they've already done. So it seems that the local, the most restrictive of the local ordinances, where they can kind of control.
Right. And then we have to ask a preemptive question to every landlord who calls our firm, and that is, have you registered your property as a landlord? Because most jurisdictions, local jurisdictions, require you register or else you can't do any evictions or send any notices.
That's in effect in San Francisco as well.
Even in San Mateo, they're sending out notices that landlords of multi-unit buildings, something as small as a fourplex and maybe smaller, need to take out a business license now.
Right. They haven't restricted yet that you can't file an unlawful detainer unless you show evidence of that. But I think that's where it's going. It will eventually go to that extent.
Well, in San Francisco, if landlords do not register all of the residential properties, and it doesn't matter whether the landlord rents it out at this time or not, but any residential properties, then they don't get, they have to pay the fee, then that severely restricts what they can do with renting it out. And if the property is already rented, then the landlord cannot raise rents or anything without the license from the registry.
Yeah, it's all still pretty new. I think it just came into effect last year was when the registrations occurred. Is that your recollection, Jessica?
Right, for properties, property owners who own 10 buildings with 10 or more units, they had to register last year, and then everybody else had to register this year by the beginning of April. I mean, sorry, at the beginning of March.
And I know we've done some evictions in San Jose, and you have to register there as well in San Jose.
So
and I think I read that Oakland is looking at it as well. So
and Palo Alto as well, you have to register. I've had some cases there too.
It seems that we're about 3 years into a much more restrictive regimen that clearly has the effect of regulating and reining in landlords. Has anybody done any studies that you've seen about the effect this might have on the housing stock, whether maintenance has been deferred or units have been closed out to renters?
I'm not aware of anything off the top of my head.
I'm not either. What I've seen in my practice, Jeff, is a lot of non-payment of rent. And, you know, just tenants aren't able to pay their rent. Some are qualified for COVID relief. I don't believe there's any relief now for quite a while. But there's a lot of non-payment of rent. That's what I'm seeing, just a lot of non-payment of rent.
We've seen in other metropolitan areas where some of the complaints were that landlords had a disincentive, and whether it's because properties haven't been maintained or whether it's because there's a real incentive to get out of the business and convert to ownership rather than renting. I'm just curious if anything has been shown in California and specifically in the Bay Area.
I'm not aware of any studies in that area.
Not off the top of my head. I've read some articles that have to do with something we mentioned before we came on air, which is that a lot of the cities and counties are not building sufficient affordable housing, and the state is now deciding to crack down on that and is trying to, you know, enforce that more.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. it's hard to imagine another entity such as KALW opening its arms for a program such as this, providing free legal advice, answering your calls on or off the air, making experts such as our guests tonight available to you that you can help with simple legal issues and maybe giving you the next steps to take. There's no other entity such as this within the Bay Area. We're asking for those of you listening to consider making a donation. For those that have pledged before, maybe make it a monthly donation. For those that are new to listening to KALW, think about a program such as this one and what that is worth to you. What's it really worth to be able to call in and get free legal advice such as this when you're facing problems as a landlord or as a tenant, whether it's commercial or whether it's residential, and so many other arenas that we deal with week after week, month after month, making this available to you?
I think it's worth at least $50 a year, Jeff. That's our basic membership level to support KALW. And you know what, Jeff? This is not only the last day of the KALW Spring Membership Drive. We are in the final 6 hours of the drive, and we're working on a $25,000 match. And word from the phone room is we're still quite a ways away from making it. And your contribution can get us one step closer. So please help us out by calling 800-525-9917 or go online kalw.org. Jeff, I think it would be great if we could get five of your listeners to step up to the plate and be counted. 800-525-9917 or online kalw.org. $50 a year. That's all it takes to join KALW. If you can afford a little more, consider becoming a monthly supporter at $10, $15, $20 a month. The sky's the limit. You choose the level of support. But do it now while we are still asking for your support during this last day of KALW Spring Membership Campaign. 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org.
And if you didn't have your pen handy when Joanne was speaking, just remember that's 800-KALW-917.
Yeah, we're looking for five of you to show your support and appreciation for your legal rights, which has been on the air for, what, over 30 years?
I believe over 40 at this point.
Yeah. Chuck Finney was the longtime host of this program. He passed away. And Jeff Hayden has now stepped into the breach, and he's done a heroic job of filling in for Chuck. As those of you who are regular listeners to Your Legal Rights knows, Jeff really goes the extra mile. He covers the controversies of the day, whether it's abortion rights, criminal justice, landlord-tenant, cryptocurrency. You're not going to hear these in-depth discussions on any other radio station. And that's why you listen to KALW and Your Legal Rights. And that's why you need to call now, 800-525-9917 or online kalw.org.
And with that, let's return back to our program on landlord-tenant law. Landlord-tenant law has often been a source of all of the calls. We're very happy to take your calls and answer your questions at 866-798-8255. We were talking a little bit about what's changed in the last few years. The Tenant Protection Act of 2019, and whether a national standard would likely change things in California, or if it would defer to California the way that the state of California defers to more restrictive local ordinances. Jessica, you look like you're jumping in to speak.
Yeah, I think that we're going to have some similar situation with that. California, in acting the Tenant Protection Act of 2019, attempted to not step on the toes of local places, counties or cities that had their own rent control, or like San Francisco, their rent control was established as far back as 1980 was when it went into effect. And so, I think we're going to have something similar if the federal government gets involved in, you know, the details, the day-to-day details of landlord-tenant, because while I am not necessarily a states' rights person, it is really different from state to state in the United States. And I think that a one-size-fits-all for a Midwestern state versus California versus Florida could be problematic.
And after all, an excessive rent for Cedar Rapids might not be so for San Francisco or Manhattan.
From a very... I'm sorry?
I said, Jessica, I think that's right. It's probably not going to be a good one-size-fits-all. What California did, at least for its, you know, its citizens throughout different counties, is kind of, you know, it's kind of, it's mild in comparison to other, you know, rent-controlled jurisdictions like San Francisco and Oakland. It's not as restrictive. So I imagine the federal government would do something pretty broad and minimally restrictive so that there's some protection for tenants or then some guidance for landlords, but then leave it to the jurisdictions if they want to make anything, you know, leave it to the states if they want to make anything in addition to it for their particular states. Seems like that's the way it would be done. That's what California did.
One of the things that's changed since the last time, well, actually a lot has changed since the last time that we had a landlord-tenant broadcast. The last time you were on the air in January, we were still under a statewide state of emergency. For many purposes, that has run its course. For others, it's close to the end and the deadline's in sight. How does that affect landlord-tenant law?
Well, certainly in Alameda has had a moratorium on evictions, which expires on April 31st. And so as of May 1, evictions can start up again. So evictions have been prohibited, I don't know, for about, 2 years or longer, maybe 3 years in Alameda. And so there's going to be, in my opinion, quite a lot of new evictions filed on May 1, unless there's some further extension done to that moratorium. And I'm not advocating, I don't think it is, because I've heard from mom and pop landlords in the city of Alameda, the county of Alameda, who are all saying they're going to lose their homes or their investments because they haven't gotten any payment for a year and a half, 2 years, and that's just not right. So I'm not advocating to extend it, but I'm saying, for example, in Alameda, there's going to be a whole lot of evictions starting on May 1. I don't know. Would you agree with that, Jessica?
I think there's probably a bit more groundswell there on the landlord side than there is in other places that have had longstanding rent control and eviction control and are not subject at the moment to ongoing COVID-19 related states of emergency. The statewide A state of emergency for COVID-19 ended February 28th, and the San Francisco one did also. However, because of past weather and things like that, there's other states of emergency that have been declared for particular counties or, you know, to do this with the weather, things like that. So that is, those states of emergency also trigger the anti-price gouging rule limiting increases to 10%.
So we're really talking about two distinct things that seem to fall under the same umbrella. One is the protection against eviction, but the other is the protection against price gouging.
Yes.
Right.
Is the analysis similar?
I don't think so, because I don't think there's too much arguments in favor of price gouging. I think that's in most people's eyes, a despicable thing. And I think even in most landlords, I mean, Sal knows he probably has a lot more landlords than my firm does. But I mean, I've rarely had a landlord who wants to raise the rent more than 10%. I don't know, but what about you, Sal?
David, you're absolutely right. They don't. Now, you know, there's some landlords who, you know, they've got tenancies that have been, you know, like I have one client who has 30-year tenancies. The rents are extremely low. You know, when that's the case, they would really like to get up to market or something, half a market. You know, I mean, it's really, really, really bad in those circumstances. The building barely runs, you know, barely runs. It's almost a situation where they have to put in money out of their own pocket. And certainly they have to, if they have any legal issues, they're digging into their pocket. The building doesn't cover it. So, but those are extreme examples, and there's not that many of them that I work with. But most of the landlords are, as you say, they not looking to price gouge. They're not looking to squeeze anybody out by charging too much rent. They know their tenants, you know, they're, you know, for lack of a better term, they're friendly with their tenants. So they're not. Yeah, I have that same experience. Nobody's looking to raise the rent too high.
Also, most mom and pop landlords, they don't want their tenants to leave, because the tenant leaves, there's a vacancy period, there's a repainting, refurbishing, maybe new appliances, new carpeting. It's going to cost them $10,000 to $25,000 to refurbish the apartment to make it in rentable condition, and they're not going to take them a couple of years to recover that in most cases. Which brings up the other question of the issue of, I don't think there's any county that yet has imposed vacancy control. That is, right now, when a tenant leaves, the landlord can refurbish it or not refurbish it, whatever he wants to do, but he can also release it for any price he wants, double, triple, 500%, if he can get it. But there have been attempts to impose vacancy control. And I think if that happens, that's going to drop the other shoe on property management and landlord-tenant relations to make it not viable for small landlords to exist if they have vacancy control.
Yes, that was originally how the Berkeley Rent Control Law was written, was vacancy control. And the Costa-Hawkins Act, which has been much vilified by tenants, actually took that out but at the state level and said that California had to have vacancy decontrol so that landlords could rent at market rate and or whatever the market would bear, and so that they could get a better return on their investment.
I mean, ultimately, if we have vacancy control in that way, we're not really going to know. We're not going to have a real market. You know, it's going to kind of be a really fake market. No one's going to know what's going on. And property prices are going to be stuck. You know, they're not, which some people might like that. You know, why should we let the prices go, you know, to the market, maybe, that, you know, somebody might think. But we just won't, for better or for worse, we're not going to have it. You know, we're going to have kind of a fake market. We're not really going to know what things are would be worth, or the market, or a market reset. I don't know what the term is for it, but vacancy decontrol is definitely going to not encourage landlords to do any work to a unit when it's vacated. They'll do the minimum to meet requirements, but they're not going to make it nicer. So if a tenant wanted to pay more to live in a nicer neighborhood and have a nicer unit, probably won't be available because of the vacancy decontrol. Or vacancy control. How does that work if a 40-year tenancy vacates? They can't rent it for, you know, what's market now? You know, so anyway, I just, there'd be a lot to work out.
Time to go condo. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. And support for KALW also comes from Golden Bridges School, a nature-based preschool to eighth grade school founded by teachers located in San Francisco's Portola neighborhood. Celebrating curriculum that includes urban farming, hiking, and social justice. Alternative schooling that centers the child's experience. Discover what's possible for your family at goldenbridgesschool.org. And support for KALW also comes from our listeners. You make up 60 to 70% of KALW's operating budget. And now we're coming to you once again to ask for your support. During these last few hours of the KALW Spring Membership Campaign, the number to call is 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917, or go online, kalw.org. And thanks.
And remember, there's no place else in the Bay Area where you can call in week after week for this kind of advice. Consider what that might be worth to you. Let me turn to George in San Francisco. You've been very patient, but you are on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, thank you, and for points, plural, of clarity. You started to say something at the top of the show, which we thought would be worth repeating. We could, if you remember, you said that vacancy control might end in San Francisco on the 1st of May. Is that correct information?
So this is Sal Timpano. I don't think we were talking about vacancy control ending in April of this year. We were talking about perhaps moratoriums, particularly in Alameda County, ending.
So, in other words, it's different from eviction?
Vacancy decontrol and the moratoriums are completely different. Vacancy decontrol has to do with an empty unit and how much it can be rented for to a new tenant. Eviction moratoriums have to do with evicting tenants and, in this case, not being able to do any in Alameda County in particular. Does that straighten out your question?
Well, there's part of that question still kind of dangling in our imagination, which is that you have a tenancy. And what applies to it in different cities, the rules are not the same everywhere, right? So in San Francisco, was there going to be a change of some kind between the end of April and the beginning of May where people will have a new direction?
I'm not aware of any changes around that date in San Francisco. How about you, Jessica?
No, not in San Francisco.
Thank you very much for your response.
George, thank you for joining us. And just to clarify, I think what my guests have been saying is that the change has already occurred in San Francisco. And now at long last, Alameda County is dropping their moratorium, which has remained in effect even after it's fallen off statewide and in other areas locally to us. And I think George is gone. You know, we were talking right before the break about Alameda County's moratorium ended and whether that would trigger a flood of evictions and eviction litigation. But wasn't that the fear last year when we were talking about the statewide moratorium ending?
It was, and it seems to me that it hasn't really come to pass. In my practice in San Francisco, there's not been a rush to the courthouse in that sense. I think a lot of landlords are more willing to work with tenants to either buy out the tenancy to waive some rent or pay them some money to vacate the unit so that it can be re-rented.
Has that been your experience in other parts of the Bay Area, both David and Sal?
Yes. I mean, I usually always recommend some kind of a buyout relocation payment, and some cities and counties require relocation payment. But even if it's not, I usually recommend that rather than go to litigation, which is time consuming and very technical. If there's any mistake in anything, it gets thrown back and you have to start all over. By using a buyout or relocation payment, you have certainty. And actually, it's not that expensive if you're saving a jury trial attorney's fee that could be in excess of $10,000. And instead, you're paying it to the tenant, but you have a certainty and you know exactly what's going to happen. So I don't know. What do you think, Sal?
Same experience, David. We try to, you know, in San Francisco anyway, we've got some agencies that'll help pay rent, for example, back rent. Tenants have to qualify, but if they have a job and they merely fell behind, they probably qualify. So I've been steering a lot of non-pay cases right there. I mean, I will just call the tenant. You know, they're not represented. They're in pro per. I'll call them and say, call this number and see if you qualify for rental assistance. And then I'll talk to my landlord clients and tell them the benefits of doing that. You know, as you and Jessica might have experienced, it's hard to get a courtroom. And even though you're preparing for trial and spending the time, you're probably not getting it. You're probably going to be somehow forced into settling anyway. So rather than go after this, you know, possible trial, I've just been steering as many as I can of the non-pay cases into either settling the lawsuit early by accepting rent from one of these agencies or doing a buyout, like you were saying, yeah. David.
Yeah, but the problem, just to go the other way for argument's sake here, the problem in Alameda County is that this moratorium has been in effect so long that there are a lot of these tenants that now owe maybe a year and a half's worth of rent at $2,000 a month. That's about $36,000 that they owe. And I don't know of any agency that's going to give them or loan them $36,000. So they've sort of put themselves in harm's way by taking advantage of this moratorium and not paying the rent. So that's the problem that I'm foreseeing, why I think there's going to be a flood of evictions in Alameda, because there's so many tenants who haven't paid for over a year.
You know, the other side of that, isn't it true a lot of the time that if you have a tenant that's ready and able to make the payments, a landlord might be better off severing out and without waiving the past due, working it out with the tenant to pay prospectively and deal with the past due in another arena, whether it's a payment plan, whether it's going to small claims, but keeping the place rented so you don't have that huge turnover expense?
I see that in commercial. I have a couple where I'm suing one commercial tenant who is continuing on, but we're not suing him to evict him. We're just suing him for rent. But in the residential, I haven't really done that. I don't know if the other speakers here have done that.
I have not. The ones I've been dealing with, tenants just can't pay. And for whatever reason, they wait for an unlawful detainer. And then maybe these agencies aren't offering the money unless there's a lawsuit on file. I've never looked into that, but we've tried to get tenants to pay. I've never gotten them to pay other than, you know, with agencies helping them. And it's not, like David said, 36 months or 12 months. You know, it's something like 5 or 6 months at best. So, you know, we try to move quick in that as well. I don't think these agencies can afford 3-year non-payment of rent cases.
No, probably not.
Yeah.
Not if they want to help as many people as possible.
Right.
And so usually I would imagine that most of these agencies are aiming to help people that are lower income, that are truly in need. And at least according to the stories that we're getting on some of the local news, that may not make up the typical person in Alameda County that's fallen that far behind and hasn't been paying anything in the last few years.
Meaning that they're very wealthy tenants paying?
Well,
right,
it seems there's a mix. There's an awful lot of people that are legitimately hurting because of the pandemic or the economic downturn or the lack of available aid to assist them. But then there's others that are perhaps a little more astute and knowing how to play the game. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, and tonight we're talking landlord-tenant with three of the best. That is Sal Timpano of San Francisco, David Finkelstein of San Mateo, and Jessica Chalik of San Francisco. Of course, the best questions come from you. We're happy to take your calls. Our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. You can call on any question on landlord-tenant. You don't have to jump into our conversation. We've talked a lot about residential, but David brought up commercial. We haven't talked as much about that. One of the questions that comes up in commercial, we're not so much looking at habitability, but at least safety. Is there any guidance or legal standard for a landlord that maybe is coming information that the office space they rented or the industrial space may have problems?
Yeah, well, I think this is a frontier legal issue because until, you know, let's say, I don't know, five or 10 years ago, commercial was treated completely differently than residential. And there were cases that say the tenant can sue separately, but he's got to, that there are independent covenants in commercial, that the landlord's covenant, if it's breached, the tenant can sue separately in a separate case, but still has to pay the rent. Lately, in the last 5 years, this has been changed for serious violations, and it's moving more. Not, you know, I don't think it'll ever be totally as restrictive as residential evictions, but it's moving more in that arena. But there is a landlord also has a very much of a greater incentive to try to work out a deal, or as you said, Jeff, to continue to get ongoing rent and just sue for the back rent and not evict, because you don't just put an ad in the newspaper and the next day get a commercial tenant. As we all know, you can go by a shopping center and see vacancies that have been there for years. It could take easily a year to 2 years to replace a commercial tenant. And then you have to pay very large fees. You have to give tenant improvement allowance to the new tenant. Other matters. You may have to do ADA upgrades, Americans with disabilities upgrades, and other upgrades to the unit. So all of this could be very, very costly for the landlord. So there is an incentive for him to try to work it out, or to not release the tenant from the lease, but sue separately. At least that's been my experience.
Let me turn it to Joel from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hello. So I rent a flat in a single family home, and the government recently seized the property from our landlord. and told us that they were going to be our new landlord and we should work with them and their intentions to sell the house. But then they took that back and said, actually, we're going to sell the house, but you need to continue working with your current landlord and paying rent to them and working with them as a landlord. Now they're coming to us and asking to enter the house to do a walkthrough. My question is, do I need to comply with them because we don't have an agreement with the government? Our landlord does.
Which government agency is it?
It's Department of Homeland Security.
Oh, interesting. And the property's in where? San Francisco or somewhere else?
It's San Francisco.
All right. Well, David or Jessica might have something to add to this, but any new owner or any new management that steps into the shoes of the owner or is managing the property or the owner or is the owner can serve a notice of entry for proper reasons, like to inspect the property for repairs, for example. I don't recall if you said what your notice says, but you, from what you've told me, I think you have to open the doors and let them in. You may have a few questions and you may change the date to give you time to get answers to those questions. Otherwise, I think you would ultimately have to let them in. They have to tell you why they're coming in and it has to be a legal reason. I'll let David or Jessica jump in at this point.
I would defer to Jessica, but just from a matter of common sense, if the Federal Homeland Security Agency wanted to come into my house and they showed me proof that they were really who they were, I don't think I would say no. But maybe Jessica has some other idea.
No, not really. I think that it's not clear what the relationship is with Homeland Security as far as like if they're owner or if they're a new owner or if they're managing or if they just have an interest in the property because of, I don't know, some sort of forfeiture idea where the owner is forfeiting the property to Homeland Security. That those sorts of questions would affect, I think, my answer. If the landlord wants to come in, there's the Civil Code section 1954 is about entry, and they are allowed to come in with 24-hour written notice for the reasons allowed, including inspecting for repairs. But I'm not sure how Homeland Security would be giving that notice. On what basis, unless it was some sort of forfeiture, in which case they wouldn't want the rents to go to the owner, they would want the rents to go to them.
Strange, because if they're not coming in under that California code section, then what are they, just a government agency trying to come into somebody's home without probable cause? Can't do it. Ultimately, I think you'll probably need to show that notice of entry to an attorney and you know, get an opinion on whether or not it's a valid notice served under the proper code section. Because otherwise, it's just the government trying to trick you to let them into your house. I mean, they shouldn't come in just because they want to, you know. So anyway.
I would agree that they have to give you written notice and you should have 24 hours at least to look at it and maybe email it over to somebody who can advise you legally.
And one last thing, you can always change the time if it doesn't work for you, you know, because you need to find out if it's a valid notice. In my opinion, that's a good reason to change the time and say, look, can't do it at that time. You know, got to do it in another date and just reschedule it.
Joel, thank you for joining us. I hope that answered your question. Let me turn it to William in Belvedere. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm curious about the legal aspects of what I'm about to describe. Lately, there have been stores that have closed. For instance, not picking on anybody particular, but Macy's several years ago announced we're closing 20 stores or whatever it is. And what I wanted to know is the stores of different brands, different stores, are in different shopping centers, and therefore there must be different landlords. And what I wanted to know was if a store chain closes, say, 12 stores or something, does the lease just end automatically because they say, well, we don't want to be here anymore? You understand what I mean? Or is the larger corporation, of which the individual branches are branches, are they on the hook for the remainder of the rent on all of the leases?
I think I can answer that because I do a lot of that kind of work. It all depends on who signed the lease. With Macy's, for example, that's a company-owned store, and to my knowledge, there's no what we call franchisee who are like subleasing or operating the lease with a national name, but they're a franchisee. So for example, Macy's would be on the hook for the national company, and Macy's has, I think, at least twice in the past filed what is called a Chapter 11 proceeding in federal bankruptcy court. And they do that because under Chapter 11, they can terminate early certain leases and keep certain others.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
So if they haven't filed for Chapter 11, then they just have to continue paying the lease. The problem is that quite a number of different national names, I could mention something like McDonald's, which everybody knows. They do have national company stores that own, but they also have, I think, a majority are owned by franchisees who sign the lease. And if the franchisee signs the lease and says, I'm going out of business, the only one you could sue is that franchisee. And if he files bankruptcy, you're out of luck. So it depends on who signed your lease. It's why I tell my investor clients that I prefer them not to to buy an asset with a franchisee, but usually try, or if they do buy an asset with a franchisee, to have a corporate guarantee behind it, or otherwise just stick with the corporations that run the stores to avoid that problem.
Or some kind of a bond that will protect you. Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. We still have a moment, just a brief moment, for a call from Holly from San Francisco. You're on the air. Better times, better tight.
Hey, how's it going? I just have a quick question. I'm a small business owner in San Francisco, and there have been some, basically, like, the building that my business is in has had, like, a problem with a leak. And so when it rains, the water, like, there's water coming into the building. And the landlord uses a rental company to manage the building. And for about 5 months, I've been trying to get the rental company to come fix the leak. And they're like, well, the contractor will call you. But they never do. And one of the leaks, like, is starting to cause water damage. And I guess I'm just curious. Like, I don't want to rock the boat because it's a pretty good deal, like, lease wise, but I don't know what do you do when the landlord just doesn't respond to building issues like that?
I would recommend that you contact the San Francisco Department of Building Inspections and see if they will come out for the commercial when it's, you know, has to do with mold and you know, leaks from the exterior that would be the building's issue.
You can also contact a lawyer in San Francisco who specializes in commercial or does a lot of commercial lease work, because you have certain legal rights even as a commercial tenant, or, you know, quiet enjoyment, breach of the lease, and...
David, is repair and deduct an option in such a case?
Tried to repair it, but it's more of like a, they've sent people like two or three times over probably like 5 years trying to repair the leak, but it's probably in the foundation or something.
If you've got a good deal in that place and you're trying not to rock the boat, The suggestions you got so far are really good, but they may rock the boat. I think you better like review your lease carefully and then send a, you know, send some letters out to the management company, some nice letters to begin with, and then maybe the third or fourth letter a little tougher, and because otherwise you're gonna, you know, either suffer with this leak forever, or you're gonna rock the boat. And I don't know if you're on a month to month lease, but you probably have to get some letters in writing after you've reviewed your lease and you know what your rights are under the lease and what their obligations are.
Although I think if she complains in writing to the building department, and especially if they go out and inspect and find an issue, she, I think, may be protected by retaliatory eviction that she couldn't get evicted for about 6 months. But even if that worked, it wouldn't protect you forever, only for about 6 months.
It doesn't really seem like commercial tenants have a lot of protection as well as residential. It's just, well, there's residential above it.
I have argued that it does, and I don't know. I haven't had any judgment one way or another.
I see. Thank you.
I wasn't aware that it applies, but I don't see why it shouldn't. You know, okay. If you're getting the arguments in there, David, and getting headway, that's great. I mean, it should apply, right? There shouldn't be retaliation in these contracts. So anyway.
Okay, thanks. Have a good one.
Holly, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. And unfortunately, we have run out of time. I was hoping to circle back to you and give you each a few moments to reflect on any closing thoughts, but we are essentially at the top of the hour. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area, where tonight we focused on landlord-tenant law, where we are at this state, which is the second installment for 2023. Our guests tonight have been landlord-tenant attorneys extraordinaire, Jessica Chilek and Salvatore Timpano of San Francisco, and David Finkelstein of San Mateo. And of course, our final guest has been all of you and those of you who called in tonight. It's been a few years, but next week we take up the issue of insurance coverage. And then in 2 weeks, we offer tax filing tips, as this year's tax season is nearing a close. In 3 weeks, we return to look at elections, what the state of elections are, and open source voting software. And best of all, as always, we'll take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guests, Jessica Chilek, David Finkelstein, and Sal Timpano. And back at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night. And be safe. And if you are valuing the service we provide, the free legal advice, the fact that you can call and talk to somebody one-on-one about your problem and share ideas with your friends and neighbors to help you reason that out, please take this opportunity and consider a gift to this station, whether it's a brief monthly amount or a yearly pledge. We appreciate even the smallest amounts. Of course, we appreciate them even greater when they're not. But you're listening to Your Legal Rights. Thank you for listening.
And we want to remind everybody that support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.